Well, my name is Chris Borges, and I came to Holden in October of 1985 as the mechanic. And Carrie also came then. Carrie is my wife. We're married. I should say my wife. We came in 85, and I've been fixing flat tires and crawling under snowcats in the winter and pumping septic tanks, things like that ever since then. And I guess for that reason that Ingrid asked me to kind of introduce this and give some sort of philosophical background to some of the attitudes that we have at Old Village currently. When I came, probably the overriding concern in the village, or what had been the overriding concern and what carried over as a big focus of a lot of energy, both financial energy and human energy, was putting in the new sewer project, which had been required, or had been required of Holden for some time, and finally Holden was getting around to doing that. And in a way, I think that kind of ended up probably derailed some energy that had been going into sort of ecological type concerns with the tailings before that sewer project, because prior to the sewer project, sewage waste went to a lagoon out on the tailings, and then was pumped onto a flat part of the tailings where artichokes were grown. And that was no longer, the Forest Service didn't allow that as an option for the new sewer project, which is now a drain field down by the old miners' village towards the ballpark. So that was what was going on at the time. And I remember the winter before this past winter, Barb Rossig, who's the pastor here, had not exactly a campaign, but she had a phrase that she used once in a while. Information is power. And she was encouraging the operations staff or the operations manager to try and get information to the village about what was going on in operations. And I remember that as being a time when information started flowing a little bit more in the village. I started learning more about what was going on. When I first came, I just felt like I was pretty much up in the garage, you know, doing my job. And then this winter, something significant happened. We were without an operations manager, and Kent Burgess, who's the business manager, came in, and he ended up being the operations manager for an interim period of time this winter. Kent would say things like, "Well, if you see me with tools in my hand, you'll know the village is in big trouble." And I guess because of that sort of attitude, he kind of looked to people in sort of the operational trenches for information flowing from our direction. So then information was flowing both from, I guess, administration, and information was flowing from the trenches. And I think that suddenly people started tossing around ideas again. And there was a lot of brainstorming going on, and a lot of concern about, what's our philosophy of doing things here? Do we want to be burning as much diesel fuel as we've been burning? Do we want to be disposing of garbage the way we've been disposing of garbage? And so I think that is sort of how we got to the point we are now, or some of the concerns we have now, is because people started talking a lot more. Not that we never talked before, but it seemed like we talked about our own areas before, and areas were a little more isolated for whatever reasons. And there seemed to be a lot greater interplay of ideas. And out of that interplay of ideas, there grew a real strong commitment to trying to reduce our consumption of fossil fuel, which has been a long-standing commitment for Holden. But I think it kind of got reaffirmed this spring. Ironically, because we were much more dependent on diesel fuel this winter because our water flow was so low, and our hydroelectrical producing capacity was very low, a record low. And we ended up thinking a lot more about energy and I think reaffirmed that commitment towards reducing fossil fuel. We also reaffirmed a commitment to solid waste disposal on the tailings and doing that in a more methodical fashion. Although that had really been already affirmed by a solid waste plan that had been drawn up for the village by an engineering firm. And as we looked at garbage, people started looking at the third level, and I think that's where Stephen Kirk's commitment toward cleaning up the third level grew out of that. So that's just kind of my rough interpretation of sort of a history of how we got to the kind of commitments we have now. And Joanne and Steve and Kirk can talk a little bit more specifically about that and some of those areas.
My name is Joanne Malina. I've been at Holden Village about 10 weeks, and I'm going to be talking a little bit about garbology at Holden Village. Steve and I have been sharing the position here of coordination of garbology for about, 6 weeks or so, more or less. My first day at Holden Village was a garbage cleanup day, which involved all the staff of the village going out in the tailings and picking up the garbage that had blown out the dump over the previous winter. And so my involvement has been since that time. I think what happened at that time was a lot of people were somewhat frustrated by what was happening with the garbage that was being dumped on the tailings. And as a result, a lot of positive energy was generated to look at our garbage disposal, how we were handling garbage, and how we could change that. And I'm going to talk about a few of the changes that have taken place. Probably most evident is our method of doing garbology, or I guess our structure of the garbology department. In the past, we've had, my understanding is, 2 to 3 garbologists that do all the collecting and sorting of the garbage during the summer. And this year, we have what we call garbology or ecology teams. And what we're doing is we're involving all the staff, short-term and long-term staff, in the collecting, the sorting, and the distribution of the garbage. And the reason for this is we feel that we're really increasing awareness of the staff and increase the impact we have, hopefully, outside of the Holden Village, as a lot of staff come through the village in the summer. And involving each of them at least once while they're here in the whole process, hopefully they'll bring some changes or some different thoughts as far as their own garbage production at home from their experience here. Just some comments I've had from people who have been on the teams. We have a lot of school teachers that come through. Some of them have gone back with ideas of how they're going to involve their students in either garbage awareness or garbage collecting when they get back home. Others have mentioned how they hope to look into the recycling that goes on in their own areas when they return home. So I think we have made some impact in that area by getting the whole staff involved. We do hope to get guests more involved. We've always had an open invitation to guests to help with our garbology team efforts. So that's basically how we've restructured the whole garbology department. Just briefly, I'll mention what we do with the garbage here. We have basically 4 different options with the garbage that we collect. First, we can burn, and what we do is we burn mostly just paper products. Our cardboard products, we are recycling at this point, or we're stockpiling presently, but we hope to recycle. Secondly, we compost, and we have a composting bin system that's been set up or designed by a previous, I believe, staff member who has had a lot of experience with composting and is has a lot of experience with organic gardening. He has a booklet in the bookstore on his composting system for interested in that. We have a six bin set up on the garage level here at the Lowe's. The third way we deal with garbage is by burying, and mainly we, the non-vertical and non-compostable things turn out to be plastics, and what we end up burying in the tailings is mostly plastics, so we've been trying to come up with ideas where we can decrease our production of the influx of plastic into the valley. And one way we do get a lot of plastic, or have gotten a lot of plastic in the past, is packaging. And we have on our purchasing orders now, we do stamp them all. What the stamp says is, please do not ship in plastic or styrofoam packing. We only accept recyclable materials. And hoping to decrease the influx of plastics that way. And then the fourth way we deal with garbage is basically through recycling. Steve will talk about that.
Okay. We tried to, like Joanne said, the option, they used to bury the tailings, all the metal, glass, plastics, all the non-vertical stuff was buried and non-compostable. And so the effort to try to reduce the amount of stuff we bury, and things that are buried are hinted, it's just, obviously it just, builds up in the tailings, does nothing, it just takes up space and be there forever and ever, like glass, metal, plastics, it'll be there for eons, they'll still be around. So in an effort to reduce the amount of stuff we're burying, we started a recycling system of sorts. They were trying to recycle glass, tin cans, aluminum cans, and cardboard. And we have places that will take those things. Recycling anything, as we found out in the last couple of months, is really difficult. It's a lot of effort and a lot of energy to go about recycling, especially up here with our distance from a recycling center of sorts. We do have an advantage in a way, though, of being a very concentrated village. So we have a lot of recyclable things. We concentrate like tin cans. We go through like a can this big of crushed tin cans every couple of days. So in some ways we have an advantage in that we can live with a lot of glass and a lot of tin, a lot of stuff concentrated in a small area. But we have to get that stuff hauled out one way, you know, by either by barge or on the boat. And I guess for that part of the recycling step, that kind of, I don't know, self-explanatory, I guess to kind of turn this thing sort of towards so people can do on the outside, I guess you can maybe learn by our struggle to try to do the same kind of things on the outside. When I was out a couple weeks ago, I was out in Seattle for a week, and it's amazing how much garbage a few people can produce. Just, you know, like two people or three people can make as much garbage basically as the village does pretty easily in a couple of days. It's just amazing. When you go to the store, you buy everything you buy is coming in plastic. It comes in, you know, it's just impossible to recycle. And you really can do a lot, both by choosing what you buy and then by trying to recycle stuff that you buy. It's getting harder and harder to buy things even in glass, though, even like ketchup bottles, something as simple as that. Almost all ketchup comes in plastic bottles now. It's like, you know, the glass is recyclable, but I guess it's not as convenient as the plastic is. But, what's that?
And lighter to ship.
Lighter, yeah, that's probably true. I never thought about that. Yeah, that's a good point. But, and so I guess the way to encourage recycling and to encourage the non-use of plastics, I guess, is to try to buy stuff in recyclable containers and then try to recycle those things. And both saves energy from the digging up of the metal is dug up from the ground, the iron is dug up and it makes monstrous tailing piles similar to the ones we have, except they do like metal, you know, iron ore, iron mines. And so by recycling, we actually reduce the amount of tailings in the world, I guess you could say. We, you know, reduce our impact. The other big area we're working at on recycling is a third level, and that's sort of evolved. I'm not even sure how that evolved. It's kind of dropped. It was this idea to recycle stuff on the third level, and it's been you know, go forward ever since. But we've been trying to package the metal up and ship it out to a salvage company down in Chelan. They come pick it up on a barge. And the reasoning behind that, I think, is almost, I guess, from my perspective, it's both from the, like, the tailings model, I guess, if we recycle the stuff we have here, we actually reduce somewhat the amount of iron ore tailings in the world. But also just from the idea that the whole village has let this stuff build up over the years, almost like a guilt type thing. I guess Lutheran are famous for this, but the whole village had just taken all their stuff and just dumped it up there since they started, basically. And it was I guess the reason they started dumping the stuff is because already sort of junky to start out with. Third level had some junk up there already, so I guess they thought, well, the first couple washing machines, no big deal. And then kind of just build up. Pretty soon, I'm sure they ended up in bed springs one of the first couple of years. And pretty soon, it's all, you know, there's hundreds of thousands of pounds of scrap metal over 20 years. And so we're trying to go back to reduce that impact. I guess I'll have to say something else, I guess, towards the third level thing. Someone opened up one of the boat last week, out for a day, and talked to someone on the boat about the third level recycling thing. And they said that the thing that's really important is to make less junk in the first place, and then you wouldn't have to ship it out. And it's a really good point. And I think it's been a lot of effort. It's not been here since I've seen a lot of people do a lot of stuff to try to reduce the amount of junk we produce in the first place. Like by fixing instead of replacing, or by buying good things that won't wear out, or buy things that you can fix. And I guess that's there's one lesson to really take to the outside society is that don't buy things that are gonna, you know, wear out, or don't buy disposable things. Like, it's disposable. Our whole society seems to gear towards convenience and disposing of things. Even like, I guess, even a car can be that way, or there's just a lot of examples. You know, you can think of many examples of things that can be fixed instead of replaced.
Chris and I both have some similar views on vehicle uses, and I guess this is conservation in some ways, in that we can't stand to see anything go down the road unnecessarily. Partially, it's self-interested in some ways, because the more miles you put on, the more repairs you've got to make. But this winter, I think there was a real concerted effort on our part to limit vehicle usage. And that's a hard thing to do here, because there are several people who operate equipment, and actually there are, I don't know, probably now we've got about 15 or 20 people that can operate equipment, and we've got about 30 vehicles, and it's hard to keep that many people under rein. And so generally, like we feel now, it's kind of out of control. Maybe in the winter you can keep it under control a little bit more, but I think in the summer, at least last summer when I was here, I felt like at points it was out of control and I didn't know what I could do about it. I think we set over the winter a tone of conservatism about vehicle usage that really sunk in with the drivers, and it also, I think, affected the way they drove equipment. And basically, we went through the winter without a driver error that caused a breakdown. I mean, there were breakdowns, of course, but oftentimes you'll have breakdowns because of driver error, not noticing something or ignoring something. And basically, we didn't have that this winter. And maybe we were lucky, and we probably were. But I also like to think that, that because of this tone that we set, people were thinking in a different way about what they were doing. Likewise, in heating, this just doesn't seem to have a lot of continuity with the garbage. But another thing that we tried this winter with conservation, I guess I was a little bit involved with, was we have many of our buildings are heated with diesel fuel. And as Steve and Chris have both mentioned, that you know, we've been trying to reduce our dependence on diesel fuel. So we have a wood-fired boiler over in Chalet 1. And somehow along the line, an idea was conceived that this boiler could heat more than one building. And so, finally, I guess we got this, I guess we started figuring that this might work. We could run some pipes up to the next building, run a hot pipe up and a return pipe back to this boiler, and we could heat the next building, the neighboring building, with the same boiler. And so we went out in January, and we're, as it turned out, we were on about 7 feet of snow. And we sweated this pipe and we stuck it up there, and it was sitting above the ground all winter, and it actually did heat another building. And so we lost that second building wasn't on diesel for the rest of the winter. It was heated by the one boiler. And then this summer we're going to move that boiler out, put it into a separate structure, and put these pipes underground and heat both of these buildings. And we're going to try to take on a couple more buildings with that same boiler and take those buildings off of diesel use. I guess that somehow this fit in a lot better the last one. But I guess I really don't know what to say. I guess this is just some of the things that we've been trying to do this winter. And I guess it was no one's idea, I guess. It just a lot of support for trying to do things a little differently, and maybe trying to do things a little with a little less, trying to do it with oil instead of diesel in this case. And
what about the pollution from wood and diesel compared to in the air?
Yeah, in Seattle and Spokane, both they have wood burning bans, and they also, Washington State is now, we've got a program where you have to buy certain stoves, approved stoves, following the Oregon regulations on stoves. We're in a valley here where there isn't much concentration of pollution, so our burning makes very little impact in our area. So the air that we breathe isn't really affected by wood burning. Wood burning does, if you properly burn it, wood burns pretty well. It's not quite as clean as diesel, though. There's some soot. For ourselves here, we look at increasing our diesel use as depending on resources that we have available to ourselves, such as wood, and plus diesel is quite expensive. Diesel is real expensive by the time we ship it up here. So the increase in wood use is being a good thing for us in our situation.
And electric is, where does electric fall and all that? It's out of the question in the winter because it's too scarce?
Yeah, that's basically it. Electric's, of course, the best choice for us because our electricity is we have electricity, and we don't pay for it in the way that you folks pay for it at home. But in the winter, we don't have enough electricity to heat. We don't even have enough electricity in the summer if everyone turns on their room heaters. But of course, we don't have that many people in the winter. But we don't have enough electricity to heat ourselves with resistance.
We are doing some stuff in that area too, trying to make more effective use of the power we got. There's a very limited amount, especially like this last one. It was really limited.
Can you put another hydro on the same stream?
The limiting factor is the amount of water in the stream. That's what the limiting factor is. And one time we use all the water from the stream. So the only way to get more electricity is to find another stream. So that pretty impractical.
Those were explored when Holden originally wanted to reduce its dependence on fossil fuels at, I suppose, early 80s. They commissioned some engineering studies of different options for going totally hydro. And I think they might have included hydro project on 10 Mile Creek. They included one option was a hydro on Railroad Creek, and you know, running it down, it would be down a ways, it would be a pipe or a diversion flume, and then running wires back to town, and then making a larger storage dam used in conjunction with a new generator down here on Copper Creek. And as those got sorted out by the different agencies, the Forest Service primarily, it came down to building a bigger storage dam on 10 Mile, on Copper Creek, the creek we're currently using, and then a new generator that could be automatically variable, so when the load dropped off, it would close back the water flow, and then the dam could store more water. And then when the demand increased, it would open up and drain some of that water. But that was economically, just for the new hydro that would be a little more efficient, was pushing $500,000 just for that. And that wasn't including building a storage dam. And then in an example of like this past year when the water flow was at a record low, pretty much we were using all the water all the time. And we charted our consumption so that we could see when there were peaks and valleys in demand, and then we're able to turn on other electrical devices like water heaters to kind of fill it in. So basically we were using all the water all the time, and we wouldn't have been able to really store that much water. Maybe we could store a little. Yeah, last year was a unique year though. The year before we even heated some with we did some heating with electricity in some of the buildings. So we had probably twice as much power. The range of power we're talking about here is we got down to a low of about 30 kilowatts at the low point this winter. And going into the winter, you start at about 100 kilowatts or about 80. But I think a normal year, you have somewhere between 45 and 100 kilowatts. We're starting around 100, dropping to a low of around 45. Two winters ago, I think our low was only about 55 kilowatts. So,
kilowatts, 1,000 watts. So this year we're 30 kilowatts.
30 blow dryers about.
Yeah, about 30 blow dryers. Even less if you get the big ones.
Did you have to turn out lights? I mean, could you read in your room if you wanted with the light on?
We started turning off stuff. We started unscrewing light bulbs like every other one. Started putting in lower wattage light bulbs.
Lights are actually pretty low. Don't take much power. It takes the power of stuff like motors, like a freezer, compressor, heat, like hot water heaters. In fact, this winter, we could have six hot water heaters on it. Or like the hotel hot water heating system takes... I don't know, now the Hobart's going about 8 kilowatts, which is almost three times as much as we had, just the hot hotel hot water. So that's kind of for comparison.
The jacuzzi hot water is 24, so that's about 100 run. We shut everything off in the jacuzzi.
The heat really sucks with the power.
Sometimes when I'm on this team in methanol, I'm concerned with water temperature and grease. That's a problem, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. There's people have different opinions on that. I guess the hotel hot water is sort of my responsibility, I guess, to the plumber. I guess it's sort of been a decision. I guess I sort of feel it's been a kind of a general thing to try to use electricity instead of diesel in the hotel. We did years past, they've used diesel to heat hot water. And diesel can heat it really fast. We're a really big boiler over there. We can heat all the water very fast, very, very quick, very quickly heat all the hot water we need. We're trying a system this year, trying not to use diesel at all in the village. We haven't used any diesel in the village basically since mid-May. But we're using electricity to heat the hot water over there. So it takes longer to heat hot water, and it's less consistent. Especially this past week, they've had a few problems over there with a pump and a relay going bad. So the hot water struggle over there is a struggle, but I guess the reason we're doing that way is to avoid using diesel. People have different opinions on what we should do. I've heard a few people say it feels like we ought to just use diesel and not have to fool with, messing with the heater, because it is kind of a pain sometimes. The water runs out occasionally and stuff like that. I guess I would think that it's worth the struggle. It's worth fooling with it not to use the diesel, but everybody's got their own opinion on that. But usually the water is plenty hot. Theoretically, the water's plenty hot.
What's the poundage estimate now on stuff recycled?
Around 100,000, so
100,000.
5 weeks. So we sent out over 60,000 pounds just the last 2 weeks, which is pretty amazing. When we first started out this project, we thought we would, I guess I'd estimated 100,000 pounds of junk right there, complete total. That was pretty wobbly off. And we also thought it would take us probably years to clean the whole thing up. It's actually been done pretty amazingly fast, the amount of cleanup, the amount of smells. Mike's with them. We've been working full time up there for, 4 weeks, 5 weeks? That's basically only 2 weeks. Oh, really? That seems like a lot of it. Anyway, we get a lot of stuff. Because of more full-time people up there. People who haven't been up there, just been up there this week, people who have just been here for a week, you really wouldn't believe how much difference just 5 weeks has made up there. And it's incredible the amount of stuff that's been moved out of there. It's kind of mind-boggling to think about. But a lot of people have worked on it, a lot of hours, a lot of people.
You couldn't use more guest hours up there during the week, could you? Like 2 afternoons? Too much staff to haul out.
Our bottleneck is our cutting up of the metal, and so we're that's kind of our bottleneck right now. So we actually have enough stuff there now that after today to cut up, spend a week probably cutting up what was moved today. So that's kind of what slowed us down.
I live in Vancouver, Washington. We have a person who comes by every 4 or 5 weeks and sells recyclables. She has started picking up plastic because she said she's found a place to recycle it. So maybe it ought to be something that keep looking for it, because maybe it'll get over here. She said she has to take it to Portland. But perhaps it will, if it proves feasible in Portland, that probably means that somebody over here, Nancy or wherever, will probably start looking for that too. So that would be, keep it in the back of your mind.
All kinds of plastic, you like plastic bags, things like that?
Well, all she's taking right now are plastic kind of bottles. And that's all she's taking now.
Pop containers?
Pardon me?
Like pop containers?
Surprised me. I saw it on her list, and she says, she's found a place in Portland that takes it. In fact, I was reading the paper, maybe I'm wrong, maybe she's found it in Vancouver, because I was reading an article in the paper last week before I came. There is a company that is recycling plastics and was working out of a place called Portco and is now moving down to the port proper because they needed more room. Maybe things will get out.
One of the struggles we've had with even recycling stuff like even scrap metal, it's worth a lot more on the other side of the mountain than this side of the mountain.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, like it's worth like this third level pile of junk. If it was in Seattle, we'd be making a lot of money to get rid of this stuff. All the village would have people come pick it up, and we could be making money on it. Whereas now we're losing money sending it out.
Oh.
So even stuff like that that's pretty valuable, it's hard to get rid of. And like glass, it's a donation only in Wenatchee. Once it's in Wenatchee, it's by donation. We give it away. And so in some ways, our location on this side of the mountains is a hindrance. And even more, us being up here than we're that far from Wenatchee even. So it's kind of a but we'd like to get into that kind of thing. So I guess we're sort of committed to recycling stuff, whether it costs or not, just committed to doing it just for, which is what you almost have to be to recycle stuff to this, you know, at this stage of the game.
Well, I agree with you, it takes a lot of work and effort.
It's changing too. I read there's a lot of articles, like there's in Newsweek, I guess there's a front, I guess the front page, somebody was saying it talks about ozone and recycling, stuff like that. But as landfills become more expensive, as the landfill space becomes more expensive, recycling looks better and better, you know, financially. Mm-hmm. Which is sort of sad that it has to look good financially to ever go, but sort of that's sort of the way things are, you know, the outside and the way, I guess somewhat here too.
Well, I think pretty soon
a little effort to overcome it.
With the idea of the landfill too, we're running a room for landfills. Or even in the West, which has, you know, this all this magnificent space, that they're talking about taking garbage from Vancouver and moving it to Portland or Arlington, one or the other, or both. And that, you know, it doesn't seem that can be. And I think I look forward to the day that I look forward to particularly. But, well, in the sense I do, but that it will be legislated. Recycling will be legislated.
Basically, I think it's probably moving towards that. Landfills are really a lot of toxic gas and toxic seepage. Gets down to things like even plastics do decompose eventually, and they give off a lot of the
methane is the most obvious.
Yeah, from like compostable stuff. People throw out. I guess everybody. So I did it growing up too. People throw out oil. A lot of things could be recycled, but a lot of things are really toxic. Oil is a really toxic thing that gets in the groundwater. It can ruin, you know, huge underground reservoirs and stuff. Just get oil and stuff like that in there, like bleach, and there's just different chemicals people spray, you know, like clean chemicals, stuff like that. A lot of it's really toxic. You know, like anything was getting buried haphazardly, which is kind of sad.
If you guys would, or all of you would, envision something that Holden will have to do or should do or would be wonderful to do, like in the next 10 years, around any of these issues, the water, the garbage, the whatever, what would it be? The heating systems, you know, what would be a great thing to like do a big fundraising thing for or to?
I guess I think that's the part I disagree with, the fundraising thing. I think a lot of this stuff, kids can laugh at this, and I think a lot of things like saving diesel and recycling garbage, a lot of that the easiest things to do is to raise big money and to put a new hydroelectric plant in, or to raise big money and do this or that. But really what it takes is the lifestyle changes. You have to be willing to put up the inconvenience, and you have to be willing to live simpler or live more responsible. And I guess that's where I think the big change is going to happen. Even in Holden Village, I think that. I think a lot of times it's easy to, for the outside world is like that, telling someone like that too, it's easy to find the real flashy solutions to things, like technology can solve our problems in garbology. And maybe true to a point, but what really solves our problems is people being really responsible and willing to put up with inconvenience. So I guess I would say that would be the direction I'd like to see. I guess Holden try to work towards more intentional simplicity, I guess. In our lifestyle here, even.
What about solar heat?
Pretty practical at Golden Village because in the winter time there's not much sun, and even if it was clear every day, when that much sun, it's not clear every day.
It's
also
solar panels
in
your hospital.
Yeah.
I don't know if they were ever functional, how functional they were.
They worked in the summertime. They were taken down because they leaked, I guess.
Is that right?
And the person, there's been a lot of projects here people have done and left, and so it kind of, the person did the project in the first place, left, is probably find out the next year. But if a person who does a project leaves, then it gets kind of dropped. And so that's kind of the story behind that, I think. The thing like something like that is the panels, were, I think, were a good example of people, what things can be done. But actually, like, we're doing the same thing now with electricity as they did with solar. So in some ways, some of those things like that weren't that practical. Like when we had sun, we had electricity. So in some ways, solar is really impractical world, but like it's the most, in some ways it's the most crazy thing you've ever heard of. Solar heat here is just, you know, it seems crazy when you think about it.
Well, time you needed the most of the sunshine.
Right.
Winter.
The other thing is nobody's running out like your room heaters when it's sunny.
Yeah.
So there's plenty of power to pour into hot water. On cold days when everybody's got the resistance heat on in their rooms,
the sun.
You need it up there, and so it's,
and that's what Stephen's saying, that wireless solution.
And windmills? You have to be up in the mountain.
How much wind in this valley?
Yesterday would have been, but today.
Yeah.
In the summertime, the wind blows because of the heat, the convection, you know, currents, but in the wintertime, it's most times really still.
Generally, the snow falls straight down here.
I guess for myself, I look at it, we've really got a good system.